The Rebel Capitalist Show, Episode 17. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. I interviewed his good buddy, Brent Johnson, the other day. So today, I'm super excited to get Luke Grohman on the show. Luke, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here, George.
All right. Now, Brent's got a view of the dollar where he sees it going up quite a bit before it starts to come down. You guys both agree long term. But in the short term, you don't see it that way. You see it kind of going straight down. So I asked him to explain his dollar milkshake theory for kind of like at a third grade level. And he said that wouldn't be a problem because he hadn't graduated from the fourth grade. So my point is I was hoping that you could kind of explain how you see things at that kind of same level. And then I might just interject every once in a while to maybe clear things up, because I know it's the lingo can be esoteric every once
in a while. Sure. So, you know, I think we agree on a lot. We probably agree on more than we disagree on. And I think the key difference is ultimately no one's more short dollars than the United States government, number one, anywhere. And number two, the United States government has a printing press. And number three, there are very few governments in history that have gone without currency for lack of printing a fiat currency.
Right.
So basically that's the short version of, I think, where, you know, the key crux of where our views differ.
Okay. So when you say the United States is short on dollars, I think you're talking about, I kind of think back to that last interview that you did with Eric on Macro Voices, who's a good buddy of mine, where you're talking about the repo market, and you said that was the crisis moment, or what you thought was the crisis moment, and then the Fed, and which I didn't even know this, in the next 6 months has to roll over something to the tune of $7 trillion, maybe $7 trillion plus. So is that what you're talking about when you're saying that the U.S. is short on dollars?
Yeah, ultimately, right? So the dollar shortage, or, you know, this sort of dollar squeeze that feeds into Brent's milkshake view is ultimately, you know, tied in with the euro dollar market, where you've got, there's been a bunch of borrowing in dollars globally. Okay. In very large amounts. And when it's done offshore in the euro dollar market, they don't have the ability to create the base money to address that. And so you get this dollar shortage, and it's you know, supply demand, as Brent talked about. The reason I say the U.S. government's more short dollars than anybody is exactly what you just said. Is if you look at the U.S.'s gross issuance of treasuries, last year they issued on a net basis, on a gross basis, $11.5 trillion, right? So there's a lot of double counting within that number. But the key is that for our purposes, that's the number, because any one of those roles can't fail. If any of those roles fail, the wheels come off the cart.
Right.
And so you basically need to roll on average about $40 or $50 billion per day, every day, every trading day of the year. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, when you compare those amounts to the amounts that the emerging markets are short, et cetera, all these other borrowings, they dwarf them both in size and in immediacy. And, you know, Brent's point, I'm sure, would be, well, that's exactly why I'm bullish the dollar, is they're going to get their dollars and nobody else is. And importantly, I think Brent's exactly right on that. The key is when the borrowing, when the government soaks up the entire marginal borrowing capacity of the private sector in the United States, that is going to create a squeeze on rates. And whenever that does, that's when sort of that's the tipping point. And that was where we reached in the repo crisis, right? People say, well, why aren't long rates rising? Well, long rates aren't rising because that's not where the mismatch is. The mismatch is at the short end, and rates did rise. You know, repo went to 10.
You know, right. I think you just pointed out a really interesting fact that not too many people realize is if you look at the public or the amount of savings that's in the United States. I mean, the official numbers say 5 or 6%, but I don't really buy that. If you look at how the numbers are calculated, I think it's closer to maybe 2 or 3%. So to your point is, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want to put words in your mouth, is that there's just not enough savings to buy the amount of treasuries that the government is issuing because of their deficits. And therefore, those rates have to rise. And that's what most people are worried about. But they should have been worried about the short end or those rates, because that's what we saw spike up in the repo market. So there's two areas of dollar shortage. You've got the federal government on that side, and then the other bucket, which is the financial plumbing of the entire financial system in the United States. And that's where we see it on the short end. Is that, am I seeing that right?
So I guess the best way to, the reason you're seeing it at the short end of the plumbing is because, call it 70% of that $11.5 trillion is being rolled at the short end, right? So you're at 6 months and under in terms of that gross amount. And so it's overwhelmingly being rolled at the short end.
Okay, right.
And that's ultimately why. So that's where you're seeing this supply-demand mismatch. And yeah, because the amounts are now getting so big relative to the private savings in the United States, you're basically crowding out the U.S.'s own banking system. And you saw symptoms of that begin in March of last year when Fed funds went over IOER and then persisted there. And that forced the Fed to cut IOER, or interest on excess reserves. That didn't work. They cut rates, Fed funds rates. That didn't work. And then finally, you had the repo rate spike. And, you know, that forced them to grow the balance sheet or implement the temporary repo, which we're now almost 6 months into. And also a few weeks later, the growth of the balance sheet, renewed growth of the balance sheet.
Yeah, so that brings me to one thing I wanted to touch on. As you pointed out, the repo intervention, if you want to call it that, by the Fed, it seems like it's now going to be permanent, or at least that's the way it looks to me. So my first question would be, do you see it that same way? And if you do see it that way, what are the unintended consequences? Because from my standpoint, it looks like that could just create a huge moral hazard for all these banks that know that there's kind of a lender there that will take any type of garbage collateral that they have and basically give them any amount of money that they need.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, in terms of, I guess there's two questions there. And the first is, do I think it's permanent? Yes, is the short answer. The longer version is I think they are very reticent to prove that it's permanent. And so I think they could try to reel it back in. I think that would be a very bad idea, but that doesn't mean they won't try. So it's possible that they could try to, you know, begin to reverse some of that. And I think that would probably be very bad for risk assets, probably be very good for the dollar. You know, in terms of the moral hazard, yes, you know, but I think importantly, you know, as it stands now, they're only buying, you know, high grade collateral, right? So it's T-bills, it's, you know, I believe some mortgage backs, you know, agencies. So, you know, they're not just taking anything off the books. And that's where they, you know, I think is a key crux, you know, number one, that it's T-bills, and number two, that it's, you know, either treasuries or agencies. But what they're saying is, you know, this isn't QE because we're not, you know, we're not going way out on the curve. We're not buying coupon issuance. We're not easing credit conditions for the broader economy. And that's disingenuous at best, in my view, simply because when you look at where we are, they're effectively easing credit for the government. I mean, they could have easily stood aside in September, let repo go to 10%. And, you know, had they done that, you know, the marginal bid for treasuries is coming from repo financed hedge funds and institutions. And so the reality is the marginal bid for treasuries would have priced out treasuries at 10 or 11% yields. So treasuries would have collapsed. Mortgages would have collapsed. The equity market would have collapsed. Housing would have collapsed. Banks would have collapsed. They didn't have the choice. So it really is credit easing for the U.S. government.
Right. And just to back up a little bit so everyone understands what you're saying, the layman's version of that is if they would have let the repo market go, interest rates on everything else
would have reset the repo market.
Yeah, the mortgage rate, the borrowing rate for the federal government, which is now approximately 2%, because to your point, they roll over everything in such short term, that everything would reset to that repo rate of 10%. So you can imagine that what happened to the stock market, as an example, when the 10-year gets up to, you know, 3, 3.5, that might be the threshold. Just imagine the 10-year at 10% and what it would do to not only the U.S. economy, but I think the point that you made with Eric the other day is the entire world economy would it would be really bad really quick.
Right. It would be catastrophic. And that's, you know, that I think is important to understand, because that gives us, you know, sort of the motivation level of the Fed to prevent this from happening. And so when you say, well, will they, you know, what will they do to keep yields from rising? And the answer is they'll do anything. You know, they may try to play coy, but they will do anything. They will print as much as they need to print, because the alternative is just so ghastly.
Right. And this brings me to another point that I had written down here. I did a few videos this past week where I did quite a bit of research on comparing the Fed's balance sheet to the interest rate on the 10-year. And what I saw, and I don't know if I'm just not seeing it right. I mean, I'm just looking at just very simple spread or graphs and charts on Google. But it looks like when they do QE, or they, not just QE, but whenever they increase the size of their balance sheet since 2008, it tends to push up rates on the 10-year, not push them down, which is completely counterintuitive to what people would think, because the majority of that balance sheet expansion is to create more demand for those 10-year. But it looks like the market, whenever they increase their balance sheet to do that, says, no. We're not playing this. Either the market's worried about inflation, or they're kind of rolling over into the equities market because they think that's going to boost the equities market. I'm not sure which it is, but my point is, if we know the 10-year rising can crush the entire economy, how does that work if every single time the Fed tries to increase their balance sheet to hold those rates down, the interest rates go higher? It seems like they've painted themselves into a corner where they can't do anything. Am I seeing it right, or is there something I'm missing there?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think a lot of it is tied to inflation expectations at the long end of the curve once they start, you know, growing the balance sheet. And so, yeah, that's the case. Now, in terms of being cornered, you know, they're sort of cornered. They're not on their tippy toes yet and in that corner. And I think that's where they'll go ultimately. And by that, I mean, like you said before, whether it's 3 or 3.25, that seems to be the level on the 10-year where the economy really starts to slow. The stock market sort of has sold off at those levels over the last 5, 6 years. You know, obviously we're at, you know, whatever we are today, 1.75 or 1.75% on the 10-year. They've got some, they've got some room between here and there. And, you know, importantly, I think that's a 3 to 3.25 is probably a moving bogey, moving down in terms of, you know, where it starts to be problematic, because the levels of debt in aggregate are moving up over time. So they have some room. But I think your broader point is dead on, which is at some point, you know, they get to a point where they've got to keep doing this at the front end, you know, to keep injecting dollar liquidity to supplement the private sector's ability to hold treasuries or buy incremental treasuries. And, you know, the long end at some point in theory will revolt or back up to a level, you know, revolt's too strong a word, but back up to a level where, you know, that is suddenly counterproductive to the broader economy, which is ironic then, because if it slows the economy, the amount of issuance of treasuries is actually going to rise, not shrink. And so they'll actually be working against themselves. And I think as we near that point, you know, I think that point exists. I don't know where that is, but I think as we near it, that's going to put them really in that sort of on their tippy toes, in the corner, puts them in a bind. And, you know, I think where that goes ultimately is, you know, Bernanke talked about this in his O2 deflation speech, what they did in World War II, which was, you know, they set the short end of the curve at 3/8%, and they bought as much as 90% of short-term issuance, and they set the middle of the curve at 7/8%. And then they set the long end at 2.5%, and they grew their balance sheet, whatever they needed to do to keep those, you know, the prices of the bonds there. And there is nothing that stops them from doing that. They, you know, when they create currency, they create an asset and a liability at the same time. And so their balance sheet is theoretically infinite. So they can absolutely do that. And that's where I think, that's what I think sort of the end game is, if you will, of them basically, you know, we refer to as a Frankenstein yield curve. You know, you'll 3/8, 7/8, 2.5 from, you know, call it 3 months to 10 years. And, you know, it'll be positively sloping. You know, the banks will be able to make some money with that positively sloping curve. But boy, it's going to be, you know, the balance sheet may be growing really, really rapidly. And that lends into some other potential second and third derivative impacts in terms of banks lending, you know, spreads, because if they're doing that, in theory, spreads will be blowing out if for no other reason than inflation. So now are they going to get involved in agencies? Are they going to get involved in the corporate market? And it's a very slippery slope that they're, you know, they're now sliding down already, right? It's not like they haven't stepped off. They've stepped off.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm just kind of thinking through the rough numbers in my head. And if, and I know this is very kind of third grade math, but if it took, assuming it took them 4.5 trillion on their balance sheet, roughly, you know, I think they're at 800 when they started, 800 billion. Now they're at 4.5 trillion. And when rates, when they began that, rates, I think were around 5 or 5.2. So if we can safely conclude that it took them almost 4 trillion to get rates from 5% down to 0%, and then that additional $4 trillion on their balance sheet actually made rates go up, not down. I'm trying to think, how much would they have to add to the balance sheet to fix those rates like they did it in World War II? I mean, is that 10 trillion? Is that 20 trillion? I mean, it seems like that's just a ridiculous number.
It's a big number.
I hope I'm wrong.
No, it's a big number. And it's, you know, whether it's 10 or 15 or 20, I mean, it's difficult to know. The way I think, you know, to think about it, and not the way, but a way to think about it is if you look at, you know, the entitlement picture and what's going to happen with that. I mean, it's already cash flow negative, so to speak. Those are basically off balance sheet liabilities that are coming on sort of a pay as you go basis. They're not altogether different from what AIG did, which is to say they wrote an insurance policy that they reserved basically no capital against. And so when they actually had to start paying out on that insurance policy, you know, AIG needed a federal bailout. And in the same way, the U.S. government wrote a $100 to $200 trillion insurance policy in the form of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Medicare Part D to America's baby boomers and beyond. And, you know, it's not like anyone can be surprised that the baby boomers are all reaching age 70, right? I mean, like they were born, stand to reason, most of them are going to make it to age 70. And so this is, you know, a lack of political courage over a long period of time that is now sort of coming to roost. But the punchline is that when you start thinking about, you know, how big can the balance sheet get, I think a good starting point, at least in terms of the thought exercise, is saying, hey, you know, let's use 100 trillion. Eventually, you know, that's the present value. And you know, there's taxes coming in, et cetera. But as that number starts coming on balance sheet, you know, to me, you know, it seems like 10 trillion is probably, you know, over the night, you know, I'm not saying it's going to be 10 trillion a year from now, maybe not even 2 years from now, but, you know, three, four, you know, you can start doing the math of, hey, 3 years from now, what if the balance sheet's 10 trillion? I don't think it's crazy at all.
Yeah, I just think that going back to the amount of money that they would have to print, assuming that they stay in the repo market long term. And let's remember that their balance sheet since September 17th has been going up, I think, what, $100 billion a month, which is more than the $85 billion that it went up in QE3. So they're creating more money. They're expanding their balance sheet faster right now than they did during QE3. It seems like 10, 15, 20 trillion is just, it's almost inevitable. And to your point, it's the only possible release valve can be the dollar. I mean, that's it.
Ultimately, right? Ultimately. And you know, and to Brent's point, it's a beauty contest, right? It's a relative game. And, you know, to me, that's what makes gold, makes Bitcoin so, you know, easy, so to speak, right? You know, and I'm personally partial to gold, but I own some of both. But I don't have to get the beauty contest right.
Yeah.
I've got all that other math right. to me, the real sort of the, and it's interesting, right? It's the easy play, and it's also the high beta play. And it's the play where it seems like no matter what happens, gold wins, right? Because look, if the Fed doesn't act fast enough, we're talking about the U.S. having a credit problem. You know, we're talking about the U.S. being at risk of nominally defaulting on treasuries or on entitlements. And, you know, practically speaking, I understand the flows, the reflexive flows to treasuries versus other, currencies, et cetera. That said, I think there was a really important hint dropped in 4Q18 when, you know, we had this crisis, this sell-off, and gold actually rose significantly, which I think there's still a lot of people sort of, fighting the last war, saying, hey, if there's a big crisis like in 08, gold will sell off for liquidity like everything else. And I'm not so sure that's the case, because we're now, you know, that was a systemic, you know, credit crisis. People still, you know, the U.S. balance sheet wasn't over 100% of GDP. Demographics were 12 years younger. I don't think there's a lot of people there yet, but there's a growing number of people that are realizing this is a, you know, this is a systemic sovereign problem for everybody, all the Western sovereigns.
Yeah. So you're in this business from an insider's perspective, or you know this business from an insider's perspective. And one thing that I thought was really interesting in your conversation with Eric is I think he asked you about the repo market being this crisis situation. Like, that is the crisis that the market is looking for. And I think you said it was the Fed's do whatever it takes moment, like Draghi and the ECB. But yet since then, we've had everyone going into risk assets. And for the layman, that just means that they're piling into the stock market and into equities. And you guys had a conversation about how are all of these professional investors, I mean, these guys that are pros, do this for a living, how can they not see this? Because I'm just some schmuck. I've never taken an econ class. I've never taken a finance class. And when I listen to what you're talking about with Eric about the repo market, or what we're talking about, or if I just do some basic homework on my own, just in a Google search, it seems blatantly obvious that the last place that you want to be piling into right now would be any type of risk asset. Is it that these fund managers, they don't have a choice because they have to be invested, or else their investors will take their money out and put it with someone else? Is it that they have to invest, or they're just not seeing what you're seeing and that seems so obvious to the rest of us?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. I think your point about career risk, particularly as you get into setups like you had in September of last year. I mean, it was, you get to September of last year and positioning was very, very heavy on one side of the boat. And it was the risk off, strong dollar, you know, there's going to be a problem. And then the Fed did what they did, and suddenly everybody's on the wrong side of the boat. And so when you have positioning off sides, and then something happens like that with what the Fed did at the end of the year, and, you know, sort of the inside baseball look is pretty much after Thanksgiving. I mean, the markets aren't as liquid as they used to be. Pretty much after Thanksgiving, it starts to get really thin. And so if you're behind your benchmark by a lot and it starts running away from you on a defined catalyst on September 17th, you've got 8 to 10 weeks to sort of, you know, get yourself like on the right side of the boat. Right. And so I think there was certainly an element of that, that probably has continued into the first part of this year. But I think the bigger picture, and this has sort of been my ongoing point with Eric, which is if I think it's important to look at what's happening with the U.S. fiscal situation as sort of, Argentina with U.S. characteristics, and with the reserve currency. And so some of it is it's intellectually offensive, but it's as simple as, the rarer baseball cards are worth more. As we all learned in the sandbox. And so, look, if the Fed is going to give cash to the banks, and the banks are going to give the cash to the Treasury, and Treasury's going to issue the Treasury over to the banks, and then they're going to, spend the money, and then we're going to just keep this process going, then as an investor, I start to go, all right, well, I don't love stocks at whatever multiple, But do I like Microsoft at, you know, with very little debt and, you know, whatever its coupon is in terms of the dividend relative to treasuries, like all day long? I would much rather own a share of Microsoft than a treasury bond. I'd much rather own, you know, an ounce of gold than a treasury bond. Just the it turns into this relative game of,
right.
You know, you basically are looking for hard currency. And, you know, if I described what we just talked about, you know, prior with the U.S. fiscal situation and said it was Argentina or Venezuela or Russia or any slew of emerging markets over the last 30 years, the playbook is very easy. Is get your money out of the country before everybody else and into dollars, and that's that. And the challenge is now it's in dollars, and it's not exactly easy to move dollars all over the place. Number one, by virtue of size. Number two, by virtue of regulation. And so if you want to, if you're worried about the U.S. fiscal situation, where do you go? You know, if it's me and I'm running a big portfolio that is, you know, has liquidity constraints, to me, the easiest hard currency to escape into are U.S. stocks.
Hmm. Okay. So taking that down to the average Joe level, because you're talking about, you know, what you would do if you're running money or at a large sum of money, say a guy's got $100,000 or, you know, maybe $500, $1 million, something like that. But he's just kind of, he's very scared about inflation. He's scared of deflation. He listens to you. He listens to Macro Voices, Real Vision. And he knows that not only can he understand most of what you're saying, but just intuitively, he knows that this situation is not good. And there's nothing cheap. We're in an everything bubble. It's just about understanding that everything's in a bubble and just deciding which is the bubble that's got the most potential to continue to go up type thing. And he or she doesn't like that at all. So what do they do in that case? I mean, what I do personally is I put a good portion of my money in real estate, in just little teeny single family starter homes in markets like Kansas City, and just that aren't in such a bubble like Los Angeles, just to try to, and if you can do a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, I just see it as a way to kind of collect cash flow while at the same time you're shorting the dollar. And then you have maybe 10% of your assets in gold and then 10% to speculate on something that like Bitcoin or silver, something that's not really insurance, but maybe something that you just think the price is going to go up. Other than that, what advice would you give just to the average Joe?
I think that's really good advice. I would, you know, the percentages I say on gold are right around there. And I think also, for me, I want to, whatever my, you know, advisor's sort of age of life model says I should own, you know, in bonds, they say, hey, the percentage in bonds you should own is your age, right? I would own more in stocks than than sort of that rough age, you know, life model would dictate. And particularly, I would be out of government debt entirely. You know, the bubble, the black swan is always the thing that nobody believes can happen, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, everyone that remembered the last global sovereign debt bubble is dead. And, you know, there's a line in the book, Lords of Finance, you know, said in the end, the only nation that paid the United States back in full was Finland after World War One. Everybody else haircut the debt. And that's going to happen again. I mean, you look at the numbers, the U.S. government, sovereigns more broadly, they can't keep the wheels on the cart paying a positive real rate of interest. And so they have to pay a negative real rate. And so the game is effectively understate inflation, you know, you grow the, you know, central banks print money, understate inflation, that way it keeps the coupon low on the government debt. It's a really good environment for equities, right? Because the revenues are calculated in the nominal dollars there where inflation is being understated. Their borrowing costs are being understated. And so that's sort of the playbook we've seen for 10 years, right? We've seen all these corporate buybacks. And so while I don't disagree that stocks are extended, you know, I think you probably start to consider more balance sheet, you know, considerations maybe than you have earlier in the cycle. But for me, it just is this understanding that we are in this global sovereign debt bubble. Mm-hmm. And the only way sovereigns can, you know, keep the wheels on the cart is by paying negative real rates of interest. They have to make bond certificates of confiscation. And then just sort of everything else flows from there. To your point, you borrow hey, if rates are understated, great. I'm a buyer of money, right? I'm borrowing money for an extended period of time at a fixed rate, and I'm buying a real asset. Those types of things I think make sense. You know, of course, everyone's personal situation is different, but that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, so when you're talking about the haircut, you're talking about a default in literal terms or a default as far as inflation just being
No, I
paid
think
back
it'll be
to people's
inflation.
dollars?
Yeah, no, I think it'll be inflation. It'll be, you know, in, you know, and it'll be subtle. And, you know, I think too, something we have written about has been that populism is just the marking to market of reduced living standards over an extended period of time. In other words, you know, the Fed may say inflation's whatever it is, 2.3%, what have you. You know, the challenge, of course, is of course everybody's healthcare, education, rent, food, everything's up way more than 2% CAGR, everything that matters. And
Right.
so, you know, you can do that a year or two or five. You start getting into year 10, year 20 of that, people start to get angry. And I think you're seeing that manifest. I think a lot of the populism we're seeing is ultimately a manifestation of this basically financial repression that they've been trying to run for at least 10 to 12 years and probably a bit longer, but certainly since the great financial crisis. And so it's another way in which their playbook is sort of running out of room. But it's, yeah, it is on a real basis, not a nominal. I don't think any sovereigns anywhere, certainly not the Western developed sovereigns, are going to default nominally. But you know, you go back to the last time something like this happened after World War I, you had really six major industrial powers. You had the U.S., U.K., Germany, France, Japan, and Russia. Germany hyperinflated, Russia hyperinflated, the Japanese basically devalued significantly. I don't know if it was a full hyperinflation. The UK pound was devalued significantly, the French franc was devalued significantly, and of course, the US sort of brought up the rear with FDR devaluing the dollar by 75% against gold. And so basically, in a 12-year span, come from call it, you know, no, 11-year span from 22 through 33, you had the six major industrial powers of the world on a real basis, their sovereign debt fell anywhere from 60 to 100%. And I think that that's sort of, you know, dynamic. It's the only way that they're going to be able to square the circle. People are going to get paid in nominal terms, but not in real terms.
Right, like a debt jubilee. When we talk about the debt or we talk about the dollar, it's really an issue of the dollar being, I don't want to say overpriced, but being valued extremely high relative to other currencies. That's what creates a lot of this pressure. And if I'm correct in saying that, is it possible that the US could do kind of like a Plaza Accord 2.0, like they did in 84, 85, where they devalued, or the other countries devalued the dollar by, call it 50%?
I think it's possible. I'm not sure. The short answer is I think it's possible. I think when you look at the components of, you know, the phase one of this trade deal, you know, there appear to be language around the relative currency valuations between the yuan and the dollar. And so the point is there are ways to get that done that requires cooperation, and you know, we'll see if there is that level of cooperation now. You know, the U.S. talked, the U.S. officials or former U.S. and IMF officials in the Wall Street Journal wrote an article, wrote a book about 3 years ago saying, you know, we would love to work with partners, you know, we would advise working with partners. Is what we would advise the Trump administration to do. But if the partners wouldn't work with us, then we should just do it unilaterally. And you know, there are, you know, theoretically ways you could accomplish that. But yeah, ultimately, some sort of devaluation like that would, in my opinion, be it would drive an extraordinarily powerful economic boom. Because again, people are short dollars, and we saw this a little bit in 2017-18. You know, if you remember, we came into 2018. One of the catchphrases for early 2018, 2 years ago, was, you know, global coordinated growth. There, all the strategists were saying, hey, we're seeing global coordinated growth. And that worked fine until the dollar started to strengthen. So the dollar bottomed in, you know, probably late January, early February of 2018, began rising. And pretty much as soon as the dollar started ticking up, that was the end of global coordinated growth. And what it turns out was global coordinated growth, what they thought was global coordinated growth, was actually US dollar down 12% in 2017. And so there's, you know, if you're short dollars, I mean, I would make it akin to taking out a mortgage in, you know, Mexican pesos. You take out a mortgage in Mexican peso, peso falls against the dollar, you're going to feel like you have more money to spend every month. You might go out to eat a few more times. You might go buy a new car. You might go furnish your house. It's very stimulative. And then same way, the whole world has borrowed money, you know, in dollars, and the dollar has risen on them, right? So it has been a crimp in their in a real basis in their lifestyle. And so if you were to reverse that somehow, then all of a sudden they would be in the position of a mortgage holder in Mexican pesos when the peso drops. And all of a sudden they would have more money in their local currency terms at the end of every month to spend, and there'd be a very virtuous benefit of that, in my opinion.
Yeah, a lot more purchasing power there.
Right.
So one thing I wanted to touch on is I've heard you talk a lot about the psychological component of what the Fed is doing now in the repo market and, you know, not calling it QE and all these things. And you use the Harry Potter term. Is it Voldemort? I've never seen the movie. I think it's Voldemort.
Yeah.
So could you explain that to people, how you see them trying just to completely ignore this? Because if they didn't ignore it, the ramifications of reality would just completely burst their bubble. It's like this cognitive dissonance type of thing.
Yeah. So when I talk about Voldemort, so Voldemort in the Harry Potter series is the archvillain. And for the first several books, he's rumored to be dead or maybe not, maybe coming back, maybe not coming back, but he's referred to as he who must not be named for fear of sort of summoning, you know, so don't speak of the devil. Right. Voldemort to us is a U.S. balance of payments crisis is effectively the issue, right? This dynamic we talked about earlier where, you know, the U.S. has gone from financing with central banks to financing with global pension funds to financing with, you know, the domestic private sector and banks to financing with hedge funds and the Fed. And so that's the sort of been the you know, the source of marginal financing over the last, you know, sort of shift over the last 5 years. And I think the Fed is just very, you know, it was interesting. I had an interaction with, I think it was Mark Dow the other day on Twitter, where he was defending the Fed. They were defending what Neil Kashkari was saying, which is, look, this isn't QE. And, you know, yeah. Mark Dow's point was, well, why would they, you know, why would they say it's not QE if it's QE? Because they're trying to get things stimulated anyway. Why would they not admit it? And what I said to Mark was, look, four or five different instances in the last 8 to 10 weeks, they have purchased treasuries issued either the same day or within a couple days from the date of issuance. That's direct monetization. And that is a huge red line, no in central banking dogma. And I agree with his point that if they really want to get growth going, they could admit it. But I think there's just this dogma at the Fed where I don't think they want to do that yet. That is sort of the Rubicon that they feel that they haven't crossed yet. And so if they don't talk about what this effectively is, maybe they can pull back from it. Maybe this really is temporary. Maybe it's just technical. You know, our work strongly suggests it's not. Maybe they're right, but I don't think they are.
Yeah, and you're talking about monetizing the debt. And I think why that's a four-letter word, if you will, is that the Fed and all of the Americans that have been led to believe that this economy is the best in the world and all you have to do is look at Trump's Twitter feed, since monetizing the debt has been associated with basically banana republics, then if we are all of a sudden in that category, then where does that put us and where does it put our economy that we thought was the best economy that we've ever had in American history? Is that why they're so afraid to mention the word of he who shall not be named?
I think it's more basic even than that. It's like central banking 101, right? Like okay. the point of the Fed is to, you know, backstop markets at last resort and, you know, help the movement of money throughout the U.S. and sort of all these mundane tasks that they do. It is not to, hey, 4 billion of treasuries were issued this morning and we just bought them this afternoon. You know, 40 billion issuance and we just bought 4 billion of them this afternoon. That's not really what the whole point was. And certainly, you know, in a crisis, okay. In the day-to-day functioning of money markets, yes. At $100 billion a month clip, no. That is right. Not the point. And that, I think, and so I think it's important, and it's an important distinction as well, right? If they were doing these repo, you know, programs, you know, and it was de minimis, and that was a point some of the sort of, you know, I'll call them Fed apologists, which is too strong a word, but directionally, you know, we're saying early on when they reopened this, you know, when they did the repo program initially, before they had done the open market operations, right, before they began, you know, the T-bill purchases, you know, you had a number of people saying, well, they used to do repo programs all the time, and it's just to help the money markets function. And yes, you know, there was a scale difference, and that I think is ultimately, you know, where those voices, you know, at first were saying, oh, this is temporary and technical, and this is just what they used to do. And, you know, those voices sort of went away when you go, $100 billion a month, they used to do that. And, you know, that sort of shuts down that discussion pretty quickly, right? When you're talking about the amounts that you're talking about, that's where I think you get into a slippery slope.
Yeah, the from my research and just the simple charts I've been looking at, it looks like prior to the great financial crisis, this whole financial plumbing system worked on about on a pool of about $10 billion with a B dollars. Now, if you look at a chart of the excess reserves in the system, it's up to 1.5 trillion. So, yeah, you could say, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is your point. Yeah, you could say, okay, it's kind of the same thing, but when you're comparing 1.5 trillion to 10 billion, then it's kind of different.
It's kind of different. And I don't know, you know, I'll defer to you on the 10 billion. I've not looked at that number, the trillion and a half, the excess reserves number they've talked about for sure. Yeah, I think there's a regulatory component to it that people have pointed to, right, with Basel III, where, you know, there's a higher amount of reserves needed in the system, given, you know, the way Basel requires these banks to, you know, both intraday and in, you know, end of quarter, you know, reserves against positions and holdings. But yeah, when you're talking about, you know, needing $100 billion a month, you do that number as a percent of GDP relative to the, you know, some de minimis number 10, 15, 20 years ago. That to me is where it starts to get, you know, I mean, shoot, 20 years ago, the deficit in aggregate was $300-400 billion for the year.
Yeah.
And that's what the Fed's putting down, you know, putting on the balance sheet every month now.
Yeah. I actually looked back at that same chart. It's just the Fred chart of the excess reserves. And it almost looks like it's non-existent prior to the GFC. But it's got this little teeny bleep. And you kind of zoom in on that blip, and it's 2001. It's September 11th. And so you see how much liquidity they injected into the system to get those excess reserves. And it was something like 30 billion or something like that. I mean, again,
that used to be a big number.
What, I'm sorry?
That used to be a big number.
Yeah, exactly. and now they have to do 30 billion a night, and we supposedly have the best economy of all time. So then what I was going to go into is the views on digital currency. I know that typically when I hear you on Real Vision or with Eric, you're talking about Bitcoin, gold, and stocks. So I've got a lot of guys that really like gold. So maybe get your views on how the average guy could invest in gold. I know the ETFs, especially the GLD, their custodian, I think is the correct term, is HSBC. And no one really wants HSBC as a counterparty. So I typically tell people that going into an ETF on gold is probably not as good as buying physical, but then it becomes kind of like a storage issue. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think HSBC is fine as a custodian, but I think, you know, I think for me, I look at the GLD and some of the ETFs on the gold side as trading vehicles. If you want to trade, if you want liquidity, if you're looking to make a, you know, hey, I think gold's going to go up this quarter, you know, I think those things are fine in the short run. You know, mm-hmm. I do think you have, if you read the prospectus, you know, I don't think they, for me, if I want to own gold as an investment, as a core holding, I want to buy physical, you know, either bars or coins, bullion coins. Because if you read the prospectus of, you know, of GLD, for example, and then that's a, you know, one that I'd pick on is there is, in my view, what it seems to be very clear sort of force majeure language. In other words, right. You know, the push comes to shove, they'll cash settle you. And that doesn't matter till it matters. You know, if there's something that goes on in the system and, you know, you close on a Friday night, you'll get cash settled at Friday night's close and it opens up Monday at some bigger number. You'd hate to be wrong for the right reason, so to speak. Mm-hmm. There are other ETFs that I think, you know, probably do a better job of managing that risk, you know. That to me, you know, for me personally, I would just rather, you know, sort of take away that, you know, that risk, understanding that it's, you know, it's still very liquid. It's just, you know, it's just a little bit of a little bit more effort in terms of, you know, where, you know, finding a private vaulting service and, you know, actually buying it and all that stuff. Whereas those issues are obviously, you know, less in the case of GLD and other ETFs.
Yeah. Okay. And then how do you see the miners playing into that mix? Or do you, like, when you're suggesting gold to your clients or, you know, on a podcast or something, is it just physical? Or if you want to trade it, you use an ETF, maybe not the GLD? Or do you look at miners as maybe a potential way to play gold as a speculation, but probably not insurance?
You know, I would even, if you're looking to trade gold, I would have no problem trading GLD as well. I don't think that there's any one or the other. But in terms of the miners, I think they should outperform in a cycle where gold rises. Outperform the broader markets. And to me, the key that I would watch or advise people is to just understand your jurisdictional risk. And by that, I mean, you know, confiscating, you know, it's hard to confiscate gold in vaults. It's very easy to confiscate it in the ground in some of these places where the rule of law is perhaps less robust than it is in the United States and Canada, and, you know, a few other sort of more, you know, Anglo-centered, you know, Anglo-history law. And there was a Real Vision podcast presentation with Tom Kaplan, actually, and he did a tremendous job, I think, of highlighting, that jurisdictional risk is potentially real. And so if you like gold, you know, gold miners, I think, can be a way to play that. Just understand that. And that's what we've always told clients.
Yeah. And you bring up a great point there that I wanted to ask you. Because you're a professional, I always like to get into someone's mind, because when I look at investing and doing it well, I think so many people get fixated on trying to figure out what is going up or maybe what's going down as far as an asset class, but they don't pay any attention to how they segregate their portfolio and what percentage you have allocated to what. And then, to make matters worse, they pay no attention whatsoever to what their strategy could potentially be if that trade goes against them. And, so many people will go into gold, let's say, but if it goes down by 15%, now they're sweating, they can't sleep at night, and they go ahead and sell it. Then the very next day it goes to 2000, or, you know, it goes straight shot to 2000 from there. We've all heard those stories. So I think it's so much more important to understand how to organize your portfolio and how to see that, and then how to manage that once you actually take on a position. So do you have any advice on what you do and how you do that personally? Do you Sure. Like, what I do is I compartmentalize my portfolio. So I've got insurance. So if I've got insurance, I don't care what the price does. It could go down by half. I don't care, because it's just an insurance policy. If I've got a speculation or a 10% for speculation, that's something that I think is going to go up. So I'd be far more concerned if that was going against me, maybe put a stop loss on it. And then my investments, I just see that as something that pays me to own it. It's like a dividend paying stock or real estate. And again, there, I don't really care what the price does, because I'm buying the cash flow.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it. I mean, yeah, for me, you know, I think, you know, position sizing is key. When you talk about not being able to sleep if something goes against you, I think it's, you know, a function of position sizing. And I think it's a function of understanding both what you own and also why you own it. And I think you touch on that as it relates to, hey, it's insurance. I don't care. I hope my insurance goes down. It means everything else is doing well. And so I think that's, you know, how I think about it. And then I think for each person as well, you know, it's a unique, you know, risk tolerance, having liking having real estate versus, you know, equities or bonds, or, you know, what industry are you in, right? If you work in the real estate industry and you've got a bunch of real estate, you know, do you understand that, you know, you are max long real estate, and if something happens in your sector, not only is your job going to suffer possibly, but also your investments are going to suffer. You know, understanding those sort of maybe not quite as obvious correlations across, you know, for me, I'm involved in the investment research business. I have exposure to the markets. Now it's, you know, depends on, you know, where the markets are going, what I'm saying, but there's a correlation there at some level and at certain times. And so it's something I have to understand with that. So that's how I've always kind of thought about, you know, I want some, you know, some non-correlated things, some hard assets, and then, you know, phase of life, and like you said, you know, speculative stuff. I mean, I own some speculative stuff, and I, you know, pretty much, you know, carry that in my head at zero. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, you know, it is what it is. And so that's, it sounds like we sort of think about those things in a similar manner.
Yeah. And when you talk about having something that's not tied to anything else, I think that brings us to Bitcoin. It seems to me Bitcoin is kind of just on its own little island, and there's completely different variables that affect that, as opposed to real estate or the economy, or maybe there's an inverse correlation there. So how do you see Bitcoin playing into someone's portfolio, and how do you compare it to gold? For me, it's just an apples and Ford pickup truck comparison. I don't even think it's an apples to oranges, but how do you feel about that?
You know, I think Bitcoin is sort of a digital, you know, non-core, it's a neutral reserve asset, right? Is how I think about it. It's a digital neutral reserve asset. And I think gold's a neutral reserve asset as well. Now, I think the development of Bitcoin as it relates to some of the, you know, sort of, you know, technological applications, adoption rates, et cetera, I think could be very different. I also think, you know, one of my big mistakes that actually really bothered me for a while was sort of being wrong for the right reason, which was to say I was much bigger in gold than Bitcoin by quite a bit. And the gold did fine from, you know, 2000, you know, I started buying it in 2008, you know, 2011, I looked like a genius. And, you know, then, you know, 12, 13, you look like an idiot. But the, you know, Bitcoin was sort of the same trade, right? It was sort of this non-correlated with more beta, arguably. And I had known about Bitcoin by probably 2011 or 12, right? It wasn't like it was, you know, really early, but you know, I owned it for the first time in 2013, not nearly big enough. And it didn't do much, right, from 13 to 17. But then when it sort of really went, it was hard for me, because had I had the allocations opposite, you know, boy, I could have just kind of walked away at that point, right? Yes. Not that I would have, but I could have, right? That'd be sort of, you know, when it doesn't happen, you kind of go, oh, that'd be nice. Right. But I think, too, what was really interesting, when the futures market got open for Bitcoin at the end of 17, I tweeted about it a couple times. I should have been more aggressive than I was. I just, quite frankly, didn't have the stones to do it. But I said to my gut, you know, gun to my head, my gut tells me, having experienced the way that the gold market has been managed with paper derivatives, you know, the consensus was, oh, Bitcoin's being accepted, they're opening paper derivatives. And myself, a couple others are going, that's not good for Bitcoin, right? Because you're basically sucking up demand for Bitcoin away from Bitcoin. And of course, you had the 2018 sell-off, what have you. But I think Bitcoin is a neutral reserve asset at a younger stage of development, with less paper market attached to it, with, you know, I think some application type, you know, even just usage, right? Millennial, they can pick up their phone and go boop, boop, boop and buy Bitcoin. And like nobody, that you can't do that with gold, not easily, not real gold, right? Not physical gold. So I like them both as neutral reserve assets. But I'm curious why you think they're as different as they are, because that's an interesting take to me.
The reason I think they're so different is, and I'm talking about physical gold. is because just the way I see my portfolio in my mind, it's just the way I, going back to how I compartmentalize things. And because I see gold as strictly an insurance policy, it's a store of value. I know that it's going to buy me the same amount of stuff in 5 years, in 100 years, as it buys me today, as it would have bought me 50 years ago. Where I see Bitcoin is very interesting, but I see it as a speculation because the volatility is so high. If you asked me if Bitcoin is going to be worth more or less in 50 years, I would guess that it would be worth a lot more, but I wouldn't have as much confidence in it maintaining its purchasing power as I do gold. So I just put that Bitcoin in my bucket of speculation where I'm just buying it because I think that it's going to go up. And that has nothing to do with the reason that I personally buy gold. So that's why I see them as two just not even apples and oranges. But I like them both.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I understand what you mean now. Yeah,
so you've been very, very gracious with your time, Luke. I want to ask you one more quick question, if you don't mind. And this is just kind of from a personal standpoint. It's more of a selfish question. I mean, you've done a lot of research on gold. You're a pro at this. What typically is the driver of the gold price? Is it inflation? Is it fear? Is it a lack of confidence in the central banks in the system, like Jim Grant says? What do you think it is?
Yes. I think it's all of those things in various amounts at various times. I mean, I think in the short run, it's real rates, that drives sort of the particularly the traders, are very tied with real rates. But I think we're getting into this interesting part of the cycle where I think every day more people realize that, sort of the Western sovereign picture is what it is. And there is no escape there's sort of no earning our way out of this, right? 10 years ago, 12 years ago, after 08, yes, the sovereign balance sheets blew out, but we'll earn our way out of it. You could pretend. That sort of illusion has been completely removed. And so I think it's increasingly being supported by that sort of, that Jim Grant view of sort of lack of faith in central banks, increased realization of that really some version of MMT or debt jubilee on a real basis is coming. And I think it's interesting you're seeing, 2010, global central banks turned buyer. Last year, they bought more gold in any year in 50 years or something, right? So you're seeing it return to the system now as well. And so it's been interesting to me to see how it trades. Real rates go real negative. You have a whole bunch of spike in negative nominal interest rate debt, and gold does well. Okay, that makes sense. And then, the amount of negative interest rate debt falls tremendously, and gold sort of holds in there, right? And so I think that to me speaks to maybe a bit of a baton pass from this purely trader mentality of the real rate side, where it's starting to be more of this structural strong hands. Okay, we're just in the part of the cycle where you want to own gold. And, we're by the end of this part, it'll be repriced and things will be sort of back to normal. And then we can sort of move on. And, by the way, if things really go sideways, then great. It's a really good insurance hedge. But I think it's a number of different things at different times of the cycle, depending on sort of where you are, both the short cycle and the interest rate cycle, but then also sort of this, this long cycle or Kondratiev cycle that I think, this fourth turning that I think we're sort of coming into sort of a, coming to a denouement over the next, 2 to 5 years, call it.
Yeah, and I think the social unrest comes into play there quite a bit in the fourth turning, if I'm not mistaken. So that
it can. Yeah. If managed poorly, it certainly can.
Yeah. All right, Luke Grohman. Well, again, I really appreciate your time. This has been fantastic. The founder of Forest for the Trees was right here. It's just really an honor to be able to ask you some questions. And I know you're really active on Twitter, so if anyone wants to find you there, I'd strongly suggest it. And is there any other areas or a website where people could learn more about you or more about the research that you do as well?
Sure thing. Absolutely. So yeah, we're on Twitter. Like you said, I have a pretty active Twitter feed. It's at Luke Grohman. And then if you want to check out our website, it's fftt-llc.com. And there's a number of different links in there. We have a product called Tree Rings that has been extremely popular with investors of all types. And it's a call it a, you know, a 10 most interesting things list and some synopsis of sort of what got my attention about that. So it's a fun product to put together because there's some just sort of riffing on things, and you know, sometimes they're related, sometimes they're not related, but they tend to be sort of signposts along broader themes. So yeah, if you're interested in that, check that out at fftt-llc.com. And otherwise, it was great being on the show. I appreciate you having me on.
All right, thanks a lot, Luke.
All right, thanks, George.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.